you might not be a finance bro where you can invest 80% of your income. Like that, you have to be making crazy money to do that. But even if you can invest 5% or 10%, whatever is possible in your bank account, you don't want to give your kid everything. You want them to learn the skills. Like, are you going to teach them to fish, or are you just going to constantly give them, you know, calamari? I think like the biggest skill set that was super valuable to me was networking. Hey, what do you do? What's your job like? Where do you work? What do you do in your role? And just understanding what I would or wouldn't like about that. But I would definitely be retired right now if I didn't have kids.
I'm Frances Cook. Welcome to Making Sense, supported by KiwiBank. Having enough in investments that you don't need to work anymore sounds, frankly, hard enough for the average person. But what if you're trying to raise children as well? A notoriously expensive activity. As always, I'm a believer that it's possible as long as you've got a strategy. Today's guest has that same belief. She heard about the financial independence movement and decided actually she could go for that. So she made moves, including changing her career to boost her earning power and seriously schooling up on finances. The family is along for the ride, and safe to say, there are a few money conversations around that kitchen table. She's become so good at walking the family and money tightrope that she's now written 2 books on it, which have gone on to win awards and smash sales records. I'm joined now by Anna Christina, financial educator and author. Now, as I've just introduced you, you work as a financial educator now, but everyone starts somewhere. I want to know what first sparked your interest in money. Is this an area where you've always had a little bit of an inkling? It was talked about through your childhood, or are you someone who later in life looked at it and thought, oh gosh, I need to get to grips with it?
I think it was always a bit of an interest, and I don't know exactly where. Maybe it's my immigrant parents who talked about frugality and it's not how much you make, it's how much you save. That was very much ingrained in me. But the investing side came much later. So I was always a little bit good with money. In growing up in Canada, I worked in hospitality. So you get tips. And a lot of my friends were spending their tips, which is usually the bulk of the money you make. Whereas the money that, you know, your hourly wage is very, very little, like $8 an hour at the time. It's a small amount, whereas you're walking away with $40, $50, $100 at the end of the night. And so I wanted to do the opposite, which is where I was like, I will save my tips and I will spend the money from my wage. And just even just that kind of mindset about thinking about what money am I saving? Because it's not how much you make, it's how much you save. Propelled me to think about finances in a different way. So that was kind of my initial interest. Now, investing came much later in Canada as well. We had kind of like Super here in Australia, or is it KiwiSaver in New Zealand? We had the equivalent, which is an RRSP, or a Registered Retirement Savings Plan. But you have to put your money in. Your employer doesn't do it. They sometimes match you. And that was the other thing where I was like, I know this is a good thing for my retirement. Retirement is a million years away, but I will do it because I know that it grows, but I'm not sure how. So that was the only thing I did. And it was much later that I really learned about investing in my late 20s and my 30s.
Yeah. And I'd like to talk about that a bit more, because I think, I mean, I've talked to a few people who've come from, you know, they had parents who immigrated from different parts of the world and often worked very hard to do that. You know, like, it's a generalization, and so I'd love you to speak to your experience on this more. But often it's that working really hard, scrimping, saving, creating security through that hard work. And then sometimes once you're in that country, it might be slightly different for the kids who grow up with a different opportunity, a slightly different mindset. So was that something that impacted your childhood? What was that like?
Yeah, I think it's so great, because like there's that book where it's like The Millionaire Next Door, where they talked a lot about how generations who've immigrated came from nothing and built something and built businesses. And that was very much my father, you know. So there was a bit of that mentality, whereas my generation was like, well, you get everything because we work so hard and we can give it to you. And I don't mean you get everything, like I wasn't getting anything, but I saw with some of my friends, parents buying them cars and really supporting them financially. Whereas for me, that wasn't the case. I mean, they supported me in some ways financially, but also you have to work hard to get the thing because you probably know as a parent as well, it's like you want to think about what values am I going to instill in my kids? And similarly, I think if you come from nothing and you've built something, you want to share some of that with your family. That's a really important part of your upbringing and values. But it is difficult to balance that. Like, you don't want to give your kid everything. You want them to learn the skills. Like, are you going to teach them to fish or are you just going to constantly give them, you know, calamari? Like, what are the choices you're making here? So I would definitely say that impacted me, you know, in terms of their support of valuing what you have. Don't break yourself. Like, put leather polish on your shoes. Like, those kind of immigrant mentality is definitely a part of some of the frugality that I grew up with.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Where 100% identify with that. My mum comes from England, so it's a very different sort of story on that front. But in terms of other parts of my childhood, we had some really quite extremely tough times where at points, you know, there was questions about how we were going to eat, you know, things like that. And it does really instill that sense of work hard to get ahead, yada, yada, yada. And now, who knows how long anything lasts in this life, but certainly with where things are at currently, my kids will probably have a very different experience. And I worry about them not being instilled with those values of work hard. Like, you really don't want to make life too easy for kids. You do want them to work hard and know how to work hard. That's hard, right? How do you approach that balance as you're navigating sort of your own past and then bringing up your own kids?
I struggle with that quite a bit. Like, my kids are quite young. I've got an almost 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. And the other day, one of them had surgery and we thought, hey, it'd be nice to just give you a little car because you're going to be at home. You're going to have to be recovering. And the older kid broke the car.
Oh, no.
And was like, that's okay, mama. We'll buy a new one. And I paused and I was like, where did this come from? Where's this idea of we can just afford a new one, right? Like, where? How am I going to teach my child that we have to look after things and so forth? Because often when we run out of food, I'm like, oh, we have to go shopping. We'll buy more food. And that's just where I think that's come from because we don't buy a lot of toys. We don't have a lot of toys. But it is... that language is so important. How we talk about it, it's like, it's not about we can't afford it or we can't afford it, but, you know, what we value right now is what we have, so that we have to look after what we have, and how we as parents navigate wanting to give our kids things like, you know, here's a little toy. We haven't bought you something since like Christmas or your birthday, like a tiny little, like, we want to do something nice, but at the same time, we don't want you to expect it all the time or not value it or care about it. And those things are really hard. I mean, they're quite small, so these concepts are not yet interwoven into their kind of brain. But by the age of 5, kids already have a basic understanding of coins and buying. By age of 7, they already have an understanding of delayed gratification and budgeting. So it is important to have those conversations at a young age because they pick up on that, just as we did from our parents around maybe frugality or frivolous spending or what our money memories are and how they've been interwoven into how we think about money and how we interact with money. The same thing's going to happen with our kids. But to your point, everything is just so different from when we grew up. You know, just did a school tour. And one of the questions I asked was, do kids have cell phones here? Because that's not, like, my kid's 4. My kid doesn't have a mobile phone, as we say in the rest of the world. My kid doesn't have one, but I know that's going to happen in the future because all of a sudden it's going to be, well, everyone has a phone. How come I don't have a phone? And these are new things we're going to have to navigate financially because you're going to have to buy phones, pay for internet, get the iPads, get all these electronics that kids need, which cost money, but then also balance the value around that as well.
It's such a tricky balancing act. We're going to come back to this thread because you have literally written the book on talking to your kids about money and trying to give them a good upbringing, make the best of that. So there's so much to talk about there. I want to just go back a little bit to talking about your background because you actually didn't train in finance originally, did you? You started in a totally different area. What was the career path that you've taken to get to where you are now?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I have a BFA, a Bachelor of Fine Arts. So I'm actually well equipped in contemporary arts and photography and theater and so forth. And life is crazy because I think so much of how I got to where I was a lot of like having a passion for finances and personal finance. But everything kind of is interwoven in that way. So that's what I studied. And I ended up working at an art publishing company. And then I evolved into working for a university and doing courses and working like on the performance side, like theater and like working in the theater side of the university. And then I eventually went to Australia and there was a tech company that was hiring and I kind of put myself forward for doing events. And from that, I evolved and tried to move into the tech side of things because that's where I thought I kind of came across the financial independence retire early movement, the FIRE movement, and was like, so the best thing I can do is make more money. Like, there's only so much you can budget and save, but I want to make more money. And how do you make more money? If I work at a tech company already, you make more side on the tech side as opposed to the events or the cons or the, you know, HR side or whatever that might be. So I tried to move over and I did in terms of research and design. And then I wanted to become a product manager. And the reason I really was interested in that is because I loved solving problems. I loved understanding the user and what we could do on the platform to make the experience better. And I loved working with engineering and design. And so product management seemed like a good fit. And a lot of my skill set from the past in terms of bringing people together, problem solve, you know, like project, I was doing project management and product management can be quite transferable skills. And so that was my goal. I was like, listen, A, I want to expand in my career, but I also want to work in this space and make more money, essentially. So I moved into that role and worked there for a while and then eventually moved over to a fintech company where I work now. And the reason that they kind of found me was because I was blogging about personal finance. So again, this is that weird thing where you take your personal passion and it becomes a part of your personal brand. And had I not done that, I don't think I would have gotten a job in a fintech company. So long-winded story of going from art to finance in that way. And so working in that fintech company, I also took parental leave during that time. I wrote a book on how to plan financially for parenthood called Kids Ain't Cheap. And here I am now. So I'm working there, writing a second book and life is wild, really.
It is. And it's interesting because you sound like someone who's really taken charge of their career trajectory. You have built up really wide, varied skills. You've applied them in different areas. So, I mean, you say you started working for tech company and realized that there was different areas of this company that paid a lot more. How deliberate was it shifting your career and thinking, okay, I can take this skill and use it over here? And how strategic did you need to get to make this successful transition?
Oh, you know, I think this is the part that I found really hard, I think, is that you don't know what jobs are out there often, right? Like I didn't know product management was a job. You know, like I didn't know that someone could do that role. I didn't know that there were user experience researchers. Like I didn't know that that existed a while ago. And I think like the biggest skill set that was super valuable to me was networking. Hey, what do you do? What's your job like? Where do you work? What do you do in your role? And just understanding what I would or wouldn't like about that. Like, oh, that like spreadsheets do not sound interesting to me. Or data sounds really interesting to me. Like whatever it might be. And I think the curiosity is always what led me to seek out something. And so going back to your question about how deliberate was it, I don't think I was overly career driven in my earlier life. I was more experience driven. And I would actually say that I'm the same now. I'm not like, if I wanted to make more money, there are other avenues that I could do it. But I also, now I'm at that point where it's like, I'm experienced, but I want to focus on the things that I love. And that was very much my earlier career. So when I got to that point where I didn't feel inspired in my role, or I didn't feel like it was a good fit, or I was ready for the next thing, I started to then more strategically think about how can I increase my earning capacity? How can I make more money, but also feel inspired by what I'm doing? Because there's nothing worse than doing something you hate, I think. You know, even if you're paid a lot, like there's nothing worse than crying every day and hating it and at the end feeling exhausted. So a lot of it was deliberate in the sense of like, where would I feel fulfilled? Where will I get some cool experience? How are my skills transferable? And like, ultimately, how can I make more money?
And how is it to identify the transferable skills? Because that's something that gets talked about a lot these days in career advice. And yet I think when you're in it, it's that old thing of it's hard to see the wood for the trees, where it can be really hard to sort of zoom out and be like, what skills do I have that I could apply in new ways? You know, did you sit down and write it out? Did you just spend a lot of time thinking about it? Was it in those conversations with other people? How did you identify those places where you thought, ooh, I think there's something there and I'm going to give it a go?
Yeah, great question. I think perusing different job descriptions and seeing if you can envision yourself in them is a really good thing. Like, would I be happy? Would I love doing that? And then asking other people in your network what skill set they see. Because some, like, you're totally right. Like, when I write my own resumes or my own cover letters, I forget about all the skill sets I have. And it's until I talk to friends I've worked with who are like, oh, you're really great at people managing. You're really empathetic, or you're this or that, or your skill set is really great at being able to problem solve and understand the user problem. It's like, oh, great. Other people are seeing what skill sets I have that are strong that I need to like write down and hone in on, especially if I'm looking for a new role, so that I can like reiterate that back. Because you forget about those things, right? Like, in the same way that I talked about networking and how valuable that is in finding new jobs or new roles, that's a skill set of mine. But it's something I forget about because it's just me. I like chatting with people. I like talking to you, friends. It's like, what's going on? What's new? Like, tell me about your life. But that's just, I forget that that's a skill set. That's not, yes, that's me, but that's my skill set. So trying to even just talk to your own community, whether it's your partner, your friends, your colleagues, and just be like, what's my superpower in my role? And then thinking about how that superpower that you have, that skill set that you have, can be transferable in another way.
I read something the other day, and I will put my hand up right now and say, I'm not sure how legitimate this is, but I read something the other day that claimed that only about a third of people are questioners, is how they put it. So people who, when you're in a conversation with them, they ask you questions. That's only about a third of people. And that doesn't even count the people who actually ask interesting questions and questions that can propel a conversation forwards. It's just that most people don't really ask questions. And the reason I haven't looked into that stat any further is I can totally believe it. That feels about right. And it's funny that, isn't it? Where I do think most people are interested and curious about other people, but they just don't necessarily sort of push it forward and ask the questions. And yet there's so much to be gained from doing that and just having these interesting conversations with people around you. You don't have to live your life how someone else is doing it, but it can be really valuable to at least know what the options are, right?
Yeah. And if you don't ask, you don't know, right? Like, in the same way that I didn't know that there was a role called a product manager. Like, I didn't know that existed until I talked to people. And actually, one of my colleagues was like, you'd be a really good PM because you're asking the questions that PMs ask. And I was like, tell me more about what a product manager does. And similarly, I think like that's kind of where we learn our own skill sets. You know, like, you're learning from we really should be asking more questions. Being curious is so helpful in understanding other people, increasing our empathy, increasing our own understanding and knowledge, and also just creating human connection. The more we're asking, like the more I'm asking about you and tell me about your life, the more I'm connecting to you. And then that goes back into that whole creating some kind of relationship with people, which is super valuable when you're networking and so forth. And if you break it down, it makes a lot of sense, but we often don't break those things down, like why it's so valuable to just have a conversation.
100%. Okay. And then, so as you've been making all these career moves, you're building, you're working towards some things, you hit the stage of life where you're thinking kids. And yeah, the title of your book, I love it, Kids Ain't Cheap. Very true. Even if you're trying to do it as someone who values frugality, yada, 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 there are just certain things that are more expensive with kids. I mean, run us through it. I mean, not least, it starts with the maternity leave, doesn't it? Or parental leave, I should say.
Yeah, it does. And actually, I think so much of that planning could happen even before then, right? Like, as you've talked about, like, there are costs if you're carrying a child. There's a lot of medical costs, whether here in Australia, whether you want to go through the public or private system, like, those are costs as well. Everything from vitamins. And then when you're taking parental leave, there's a huge cost that happens as well, right? You're no longer working, so there's a loss of income. Expenses go up because kids ain't cheap, right? But then on top of that, you're probably losing out on your earning capacity. You're not upskilling in your job. You're probably not being looked at for promotion. So for women, unfortunately, for mothers predominantly, there is a flow-on effect, and it's called the motherhood penalty, where you're missing out on a lot of these things. Women don't return back to work as quickly or full-time as their male counterparts. And that can also, in a lot of ways, propel women to be more likely to end up in poverty or in homelessness because of that, because they've missed out on those years. So that's a huge thing that I also feel very passionate about and doesn't get talked enough about, especially when in those early years of childhood. But kids are very expensive. Here in Australia, I would guesstimate it's about almost $500,000 that they cost to raise from birth to age 18. And there's a whole bunch of other variables alongside that as well when it comes to whether you want to go to private school or public, other extracurricular activities. And then the other item on top of that is like all the hidden costs we don't think about. I don't know about your network, but a lot of my friends had a child and then they bought a house, you know, and then maybe got married, like did everything backwards, which backwards, I mean, backwards or forwards, that's just relatively speaking. But
backwards from the traditional story that was
the
sold.
Traditional way. Yes, yes. And myself included, right? Like we had our first child and then we bought a house, found out the same week we were pregnant with our second one. And you realize that there's just different costs that are then associated. You're not only are you one person is potentially on parental leave, but also getting a house and how that impacts you as well. Like there's a lot of people who are on parental leave and looking for a house and then they realize that they can't get a mortgage because they're not working. These little things seem so obvious when we're talking about it. Well, you're on leave, so therefore you have no money coming in. Therefore, it makes sense that you're not going to get a mortgage from a bank. But if you're not planning ahead of time, that might just be one thing that you haven't considered. So I tried to kind of put that all in a book in terms of all the different considerations when it comes to parenthood and raising kids and the impact that can have on your own financial future.
And it is wild, some of the hidden costs. And again, this is where I so recommend talking to other people, because if you have friends who've gone through this before you, then at least you get a heads up on some of the costs they've experienced. I don't know what the system is in Australia where you are. In New Zealand, I went through basically the public system and it was fine. I had a really good experience. And I was someone who was very lucky. I had a relatively uncomplicated pregnancy and birth. And yet, right? So I had a friend recommend that I go to a women's health physio just to check everything out, see how it's going. I thought I was totally fine. I was like, yeah, it feels fine. Turned out I had nerve damage so bad that I couldn't feel I had damage. Love that for me. My kid was giant. His giant noggin crashed on out of there and caused a bunch of damage. So I had to go to the physio quite a bit. I have private health insurance, which covers physio, except related to pregnancy and childbirth, which, can I just put out there, that's freaking misogyny. But, you know, these little things. So then I was stuck. Then I knew I had a problem. And I had to pay $200 a pop to visit this physio. Now, am I extremely lucky that I could pay that? Yes. Should I have to? I think no. And it's wild how these costs can sneak up on you, even when you think you're in a good system, good healthcare, yada, yada, yada. Sometimes you can have things that go wrong, right? It can really catch you off guard.
100%. And especially when you're talking about having private healthcare and whatnot, a lot of people need to think about that a good year ahead of time, because you often have that 1 year that you need to be on private healthcare until you want to access any of the maternal healthcare benefits. And it's often a bigger cost, which brings me back to that, to your statement about the misogyny when it comes to healthcare. And that's a whole other podcast we could do on that. But those hidden costs are huge. And then also, if you're raising kids, you don't know what kind of support they might need in the future as well. They might need testing. They might need additional disability support. They might have braces or glasses. Like, these are things, like, we don't know what we're going to get in when we have kids. We obviously want them to be healthy and well, but those are costs. And then, let alone other things that, you know, you just think is part of the package deal. You know, we used to live in a 2-bedroom, and now we have 2 kids, so we want and need a bit more space. So we've had to move to an area that was a little bit more community-based, and or we wanted to, right? Like, again, speaking from a place of privilege, but these costs add up. You know, now you're getting a house. Now you have to heat the house. Now you can't just heat one room. You have to heat all the kids' rooms, like, or it's too hot. So you need to do the air con. Like, these are additional costs that people don't think about. Driving them to their sporting event or activity or birthday party. Again, gas, insurance, additional costs that just don't get included in the holistic cost of raising kids. So they are absolutely expensive. And it's just great to plan ahead if you can, but it is very hard in a cost of living crisis.
Yes. And I think it's always really important to say, in terms of these conversations, is everyone's families are different, and the priorities will be different. But it's so good to have these conversations, that people at least know what options are there, and then they can mix and match depending on their family's needs and abilities. I mean, when it comes to kids and finances, what do you think is the hardest part about making it work? Is there an area that stands out to you that people should keep an eye out for and prepare extra for that part?
I think the biggest hit for most people are those first couple of years, especially if in, like, dual income families or even single families. Like, taking any type of parental leave is going to have a huge impact. Again, it's like you have a decrease in your income, but an increase in expenses. And so if there's anything you can do ahead of time to save up for that, especially with early education and childcare costs, like, oh, that's a huge part. Like, I know at one point it was the same amount as their rent.
Wow.
That, like, blows my mind. Like, I don't know how much it is in New Zealand, but
it
in Australia is extremely,
it's horrible.
It's extremely expensive. And there's so much more that we could do as a society to support parents. But if there's anything, like, anything as a parent that you can do, if you can plan ahead of time prior to that, that would be ideal. If you can't, know that that is a cost. And if, for example, you're planning on putting your child into public school, hopefully it'll get a little bit cheaper easier when it comes to the cash flow. But there's little things that we can do holistically to try to keep our costs down. And obviously there's a certain limit that you can. For example, if you have a mortgage, calling your bank and seeing if you can get a reduction in your interest rate. Insurance, you can usually call around or compare. Same with health insurance. These are all things that you could potentially negotiate and get a better deal on. When it comes to food, right, like doing bulk buys and bulk cooking and freezing some of that stuff can keep your costs down low. There's only a limit to how much you can do, but every dollar counts in those early years, or even just like the whole time you have kids. And then simultaneously, I think the flip side of that, you know, you try to decrease your expenses, but then increase your income. So if there is possibility to upskill, to get a better job, to do a side hustle, like, I think I saw a report from Shopify that they saw that mom entrepreneurs are one of the fastest growing areas of, you know, mom staying at home and being like, how can I make some more money on the side while I look after the kids? So if there are ways that you can increase your income, sometimes you can balance those things out. But at the end of the day, we opted for kids, and unfortunately, they just are a little bit more expensive than just looking after yourself.
They are indeed. When you look back now, I mean, obviously your kids are still quite young, so you're not looking back decades and decades. But when you look back now at the preparation you did with all the things you know now, particularly if there's anything that popped up while you were researching your book, is there anything that you look back and you wish you'd done differently?
Yeah, there's a few things. I was already, I think, before having kids and before meeting my partner, actually, I purposely was trying to save money because I wasn't sure if I would have kids with a partner. Like, I was a single person who was interested in potentially parenthood. So I was putting money aside for IVF and whatnot. And I'm really glad that I did. I froze my eggs. There was like a couple things I did for myself. And then when the time came, I just wish I went and reached out to a financial planner or a tax accountant, because there were a couple of things that I thought would put our family in a better financial situation. And again, I speak from a place of privilege. For example, I had some shares from the company. I worked at a tech company. I had a bunch of shares that I got, and I wanted to sell them in order to help buy our house. Sounds smart, right? Like you're using assets to help buy another asset. What I didn't consider was it put me in a different tax bracket because I sold those shares and now my taxable income is higher. Because of that, I didn't get paid parental leave because it put me in a different tax bracket. Had my partner done it, it would have been a different story. Again, back to being a mother this is just like the rules in Australia at the time. They've changed since. And because of that, I had to pay full price on the childcare subsidy that my kid was going to childcare. So by making one decision that you thought was going to be better because we're trying to buy a home, I actually put us in a, like when I ran the numbers, we like broke even. Like it wouldn't have made a difference if I sold those shares because of all of the costs I had to pay on top of that. So if you can, and if you're trying to make big decisions in your life, such as wanting to get ahead, like maybe you have an investment property you're trying to sell, or you have some shares, or you're thinking about how you can get certain subsidies that might be available to you, talk to someone so that you don't end up worse off. So absolutely talk to someone about that.
Like an accountant or a financial advisor, that sort of person?
Yeah.
Do you know what though? I feel like that is something that I can absolutely see me falling into that pitfall as well. You're like, got it, here we go. And then it catches you, because the problem with finances, especially these sort of various schemes that are around or tax systems, yada, yada, is there can be so many different overlapping areas. It's really hard to pick them all up for yourself. And so, yeah, bringing in a professional, if you're making a big call like that, can be really good, even though, you know, I get it. People look at that and think, I don't want to spend the money on it. Well, might cost you more not to.
Yeah. I had a financial advisor friend say, this happens all the time. This happens all the time. Parents trying to make the best financial decision for their families, and they end up doing something like that, not realizing that they now don't get certain subsidies or schemes because of the tax year they did it in. So it's something to be aware of. Again, from a place of privilege, but it is good to do any type of planning ahead of time that you can.
You mentioned way back at the beginning of our conversation coming across the FIRE movement. I want to jump on that as well, because I very clearly remember when I came across the financial independence movement and I just thought, ooh, that is so interesting. Tell me more. And at first I looked at it and I thought, I feel like this is only for tech bros from San Francisco. And then the more I looked into it, the more I was like, no, you know what? This is doable if you're strategic. It's doable. And I just remember that real moment of like, ooh, hooked, interesting. How about you? Do you remember when you first came across it? What caught your eye and what made you sort of go, ooh?
Yeah, so again, going back to being very good at saving, but not knowing anything about investing, I started Googling and I came across the FIRE movement and I was like, oh, okay. Because I was so used to having a low wage in Canada, when I came to Australia, I had a higher wage, but my cost of living was very similar. I was still, you know, living quite cheaply. And I was like, oh, my gap has grown. That gap of low expenses and high, like now I have a higher income than before. So if I can kind of invest that, I can make some money. As per the FIRE movement, right? Like the idea is, for those people who don't know, you invest your money and you can eventually, if you invest 25 times your expenses, you can potentially retire and live off that money for a long period of time. So I like jumped in. I was like, okay, great, let's do this. And that actually helped me get ahead, which is why I'm really grateful that I came across it before having kids, because it allowed me to kind of put some money aside, get dividends, get paid regularly without doing anything, watching your money grow over a longer period of time, which is really exciting. you know, I often think like when I run the numbers, or like I've roughly run the numbers, but I would definitely be retired right now if I didn't have kids, like retired early, you know.
Damn,
like
it,
I
could, kids, you better be nice.
They're so expensive. I know. Stop breaking your cars. The thing that's motivating about it is that it doesn't matter. Like, you might not be a finance bro where you can invest 80% of your income. Like, that you have to be making crazy money to do that. But even if you can invest 5% or 10%, whatever is possible in your bank account, that makes a huge difference, right? Like, I think it's, if you were to invest $100 a week over 40 years at 7% interest rate, you would potentially end up with over $1 million. So even $100 a week, like, doesn't seem like a lot, but it grows over time with compound interest. And if you run a compound interest calculator and create your own scenarios, it can be quite motivating to be like, hey, I can do this. And as someone who has loved numbers and data and sports and how do I improve myself, this is just another way to be able to like think about your own finances and what kind of life you want in the future.
And what's really interesting about the financial independence numbers, I mean, often when you throw out that, you know, saving 25 times your living costs, you can see that immediate sort of tense from people where they say, well, how on earth am I supposed to save up that amount of money? And the trick is that you're not putting it into a savings account and doing this all by yourself, right? That as you are investing it, that money then goes to work alongside you, starts earning alongside you, saving your way to that sort of target number. So hard. I don't think I could do it. But to invest your way there, nowhere near as hard, right? When your money is earning alongside you and contributing to the end goal.
Yeah, but when you're learning about that, or at least for me, it was like, where's this magical 7%?
Yeah.
Where does this magical 7% come from? How can I find a bank account that pays me 7%? And that was the part where when you're reading a lot of finance books, when you're looking at the data, it can empower you to like trust the process in some ways, right? And of course, this isn't for everyone. Investing isn't for everyone. If you have consumer debt or if you don't have an emergency fund, investing might not be for you. You have to make sure that you're in a financial secure space in order to do that. But once you kind of get there and being able to see the compounding effect, like you said, you know, you only have to save a small portion of that regularly because the compounding actually does all the heavy lifting. That's where you kind of get ahead.
100%. And that 7% that Anna mentioned there, for anyone who hasn't come across that before, that's when we're talking about sort of, you know, the average return of the share market over time, roughly 7% per year. So you can jump on this free compound interest calculators online that are totally legit, and you can put in how much you can put in each month, figure out with the 7% where that could take you over how many years. It's amazing when you start including those investment returns as well. But yes, a very good point there about make sure you're financially stable. Emergency fund, no consumer debt. Very, very important. I mean, this, you know all of this, right? Because your second book, How Not to Work Forever, love that title. So I'm going to go ahead and assume it's about financial independence.
Yeah, the soft version of financial independence, absolutely. Because for a lot of people, we don't want to work forever, right? Like, even if you love your job, would you still do your job full time if you could cut down a few days or take on that pottery, you know, project you have, or work on your house, or just, you know, write two books, whatever it might be. But the thing is, the reason that I co-wrote this work with Tash Etchman from Tash Invest, and one of the reasons we wanted to kind of write this book is we wanted to have a beginner's guide to investing and what the impact of that can be. It's not just like, hey, for my retirement or to get ahead. Like, you literally can change your life. And in many ways, both her and I have. For myself specifically, I've taken a longer parental leave because I have enabled myself to put money aside and to invest in order to have a bit of a passive income and the security to take on a passion project such as write a book, but also look after my kids during that time when it's more important for me. So this book specifically, How to Not Work Forever, really kind of gives you the blueprint of what are the things that you can do so that you can build the life that you love for yourself.
I love that so much. And I think you're absolutely spot on as well. It's like, I often refer to it as financial independence rather than FIRE, because personally, in terms of the retire early part, I'm like, I don't want to be retired per se. I love my job. I love talking to interesting people like yourself that I get to spend my time doing this. I find a real sense of purpose in teaching people about money. I know it makes a difference in people's lives because they send me messages and tell me, and that absolutely makes my day. Anyone who's ever sent me one of those messages, thank you, because you've probably made my whole week whenever you do that. And yet, you know, I think something like working 3 days a week maybe is probably somewhere around my ideal sort of Goldilocks zone, because I'm really determined to be a present parent. I'm really determined to spend time with my own parents as well, with my friends, to have hobbies, to not just be someone who can talk endlessly about compound interest. There was a lamp making workshop that popped up in my neighborhood recently, and I couldn't make it. I took on too many projects at once, and I just didn't have the spare time. And I was like, damn it, that would have been really fun, you know? I want to be able to do interesting things like that and have a lamp in the corner of the room, which I point to and say, I made that. How cool is that? You know, I want that fun, interesting life. And I think when you can cut down on work and still find that purpose and a little bit of income coming in while doing more things outside of that, that's the Goldilocks zone for me. That's my version of happy financial independence. What about you?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I love work, and there are certain parts of work that I love. I also love my passion projects. I always have things that I want to do, whether it's paint the walls in the house or write a book. But the thing is, money enables me to do that, right? Like, if you have your finances set up, you're enabled to do that. And as it goes with investing, as you know, early and often is often best. If you can start quite early, the compounding impact of that is huge. But if you can start later in life, it still makes a difference. Would you rather not start at all or start late? Like, it's great to be able to do that, because like you said, you can create the life that you want for yourself. You can do that lamp making class. And for me, it would probably be spending a lot of time and doing bushwalks with my kids, or it would also be like just working on things that I feel excited about. And similarly to you, educating, talking about finances is a part of that, but it is also not what I want to do 24/7. And that's the magic of it. That's the magic of being able to get your finances sorted so that you can live the life you love.
100%. Like, even if you have a favorite meal, do you want to have it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
No.
You want to do different things.
Yeah. Completely agree.
From the How Not to Work Forever book, is there a top tip from that that you think you would love for most people to take on board?
Yeah. One of the big things, I think, when it comes to like trying to live a life that you love or that you want, is actually spend time with yourself and thinking about your own passions, in the same way that it's so easy to get stuck in the work zone and you're like, work, 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 burnout, work, 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 burnout. I think we've all been there. But if we can create space, and this is something that I've I've been in burnout for the past year. It's been a very stressful year, writing 2 books, do not recommend that, but then also just a lot of personal things. But one of the things for me was just recently making the time to go to yoga and making the time to say actually no to the things that I don't think I'm passionate about or want to do. So it is really important for us to be honest with ourselves. Like, what do we value? And what do I value in my life? And what am I not willing to compromise or give up? And then focus on that as opposed to everything else that is so easy to be distracted by.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I had a similar sort of realization recently where I said yes to every project that came my way because I was building up cash to launch my own side business. And for anyone who follows me on social media, they'll know I've now got some courses around learning more about money. It's been fantastic to make them, but it is not cheap. It was an investment. I had to, you know, get all the web hosting, the web design, had to film videos, had to get them edited. It was actually thousands of dollars of investment into setting up this company that I'm so proud of, that I'm so pleased with. But it was a lot. And so to make that happen, I didn't want any debt. I didn't want a business loan. I just said yes to every project that came my way. And I was so incredibly busy. I'm now through that stage. Yay. But it does make you reassess and say, okay, we can do sprint mode for a while, right? But to live life that way would be so hard. It does make you recalibrate what you enjoy and what's worth it, right?
And was it worth it for you?
I mean, yes, because it was successful. If it wasn't successful, I don't think I would have been very happy at all.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. Like in life, sometimes we have to be in sprint mode, right? Like we have to just like, we got to hustle, we got to get it done. And that's what this last year was for me as well. It's like, I just have to get it done, go through the motions, get all the gray hairs. It's fine. But now it's like, what do I need? And just recently I've been thinking about like health as well. And I really need to focus on me because if I'm not mentally happy, emotionally happy, physically happy, my kids aren't going to be either, right? So I can say yes, yes, yes to everything for a short period of time, similarly to you, I have, or I can now be a bit more selective because I'm putting myself first. And we have to do that too, because if not, we're going to have burnout. And then if our health goes down the drain, we're not going to have the ability to do the things that pay the bills or our passion projects as well.
It's so true as well. You know, when we talk about sprint mode as well, it's like sprint mode is fine, but you cannot sprint a marathon. You absolutely cannot and you should never try. So you do need to know what you're building, right? And I feel like this is a very similar thing with the financial independence movement. It's more that you're sort of front loading the effort where you might work hard, invest hard for a while. And then the idea is that you can enjoy the rewards, the results of that for a long time, right? So you've obviously been building this for a long time. I'm still amazed that you did 2 books in 1 year. I simply could never. I'm in awe of you doing that.
But it's nothing to like, it's one of those things, like you probably know this, right? Like being on social media, it's social media or like you see a certain thing like, great, 2 books. Wow, 2 books in 1 year. You know what that did for my family? Like I neglected my family. I neglected my partner. I neglected my health. Of course, they're all supportive. They're all fine. They're all great now. But like that's the other side of it. No one's seen how much work you've put into your courses or what you've done behind the scenes. They just see the like, yay, this glossy, beautiful, like it's all come together. And I think that that's like something that we don't get to talk about enough as well.
It's so true. And it's really hard, even when you're trying not to do the nonsense highlight reel of social media. It's kind of impossible to give people that true picture of what's going on behind the scenes. It's just, you can't put it all up there. Probably because it would be TMI sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No one wants to see you sobbing in your pajamas over a bowl of ice cream. Like,
how does this website fit work? Someone help me. Yeah. I'm not the most tech person. I don't know what I was thinking. As you've been going through this and you've been building this and you've obviously really created, I mean, the career that you've got, at least from the outside, looks like it's quite an interesting, quite a fulfilling one now. And obviously you've built up assets, investments and things like that. So in terms of the effort you've put in and where you're at now, how much further do you have to go on your financial independence journey?
Great question. This is a very good question. Right now, I think like life is in a, it's hard to answer that question because life is in flux at the moment. Like I'm only working 2.5 days. So back to your comment about like working three days, in which case that doesn't help me reach my financial goals as quickly as I would like, but I'm okay.
But you couldn't have done that if you was where you are now anyway, right?
100%. And that's the trade-off, I think. That's the trade-off that often parents have to consider, right? Like often you hear the thing, like they're only young ones, they're only small ones, and then they go to school. My kid is going to go to school 5 days a week next year, and I won't have any days at home during the week. And I'm willing to trade off some of those things. So back to the financial side, if you can plan early and often, it's great. But if not, sometimes those trade-offs have to happen in other parts of your life. And right now, one of them is, I'm probably at my like a higher earning capacity of where I am in my career, but I'm still willing to reduce my hours because my values are in a different place. And that's often really hard, especially for women in these situations. And then especially as we're seeing more and more, we have more women who are the higher income earners in heterosexual couples. And so that's an added thing because that's the situation in my house. I'm the higher earner. And I financially, it makes more sense for me to work and my partner to take more parental leave if that's of interest. But these are just the compromises because finances, there's the number side and what makes financial sense. And then there's the emotional side. And unfortunately, sometimes the emotional side takes over. So that's where I am at.
Yeah, but the finances enable the emotional side, right? I mean, that's whenever I'm balancing up those things, I remind myself, well, how lucky am I that I get to worry about that stuff? Now, you have two books. Kids Ain't Cheap came out first. How Not to Work Forever was just released in June. It's fantastic. I do recommend people check it out. And then if people want to keep up with you right now, where do they find you?
You can find me under my name, which is Anna Christina, wherever you get your socials.
Fantastic. And highly recommend a follow there for Anna. She puts out some excellent content. So thank you so much for joining me on the pod.
Thanks so much for having me.
And if you want to come and talk to me about anything to do with money, questions you would like answered on the podcast, you know where to find me, pretty much everywhere online at Frances Cook NZ on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook. And we've also got the free weekly newsletter as well. You can find that on my website, francescook.co.nz. Sign up for that and get a free money tip in your inbox every week. Never miss out. Don't forget to subscribe to Making Sense. It is one of the best ways you can support me in this new independent adventure. You can also leave a review. You can tell your friends about this fantastic money podcast you've been listening to. Or you can just hit play every single week. I'm not fussy, but I really appreciate whichever one you do. Until next time, have a great day. Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.